morning, and may it please the court. Francesco Valentini for the United States. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The Wartime Suspension of Limitations Act suspended the statute of limitation in this case, and the district court erred in finding otherwise. One or two events must occur to trigger.
Counsel, I don't want to interrupt, but I have a kind of a threshold question. When I read the district court opinion, it started with the 1948 statute and sort of said, and I mean, it didn't indicate that that was the first time, but that sort of was the beginning of where the court started, was after World War II. And it didn't seem to reference the 1942 original statute or the amendments that came in 1944. Was that put before the district court? Did you make some of the arguments? Did the government make some of the arguments that they're making to us before the district court on those 1944 amendments?
We raised the statute of limitations as the Wartime Suspension Limitations Act as an issue for the court once the motion to dismiss was raised. We didn't raise every sort of sub-argument, but we clearly raised the claim, and I believe at some point in the district court, we offered to enlarge our briefing of the statutory history, and I believe that the district court did not find necessary to have the further history. In any event, the claim was raised, and
no, I understand the claim was waived. I'm not really raising it as much for a waiver question as more. I'm wondering why the district court didn't grapple. I found your arguments on the 1944 amendments pretty compelling, and I was sort of wondering why the district court didn't grapple with them at all. But what I'm hearing from you is you may not have raised those specific arguments. You preserved the issue on statute of limitations, but you didn't raise those specific arguments to the district court.
For various procedural reasons, not every authority was cited to the district court, to answer your question directly. And those authorities are persuasive, as Your Honor just referenced. In the limited time that is available to me today, in fact, I would like to walk the court a little bit through some of those enactments. The statute was first enacted in 1942 at the height of World War II, and it tracked a World War I precursor to that statute. And the statute covered, as enacted in 1942, all offenses that involved fraud against the United States. It did not include the which clause on which the appellee and the district court's theory relies entirely. So there was no plausible war nexus requirement when the statute was first enacted in 1942. To the contrary, in proposing the law, Representative Rankin explained that, and I'm quoting, even offenses common in times when no emergency is enforced may go unpunished because the law enforcement agencies of the government are too busy to make their routine investigations. That means that the scope of the statute as initially enacted was did not envision a war nexus requirement. The statute, as Your Honor referenced, was then expanded twice in 1944, months after D-Day at the height of World War II. That's when the which clause was first enacted, and was enacted clearly as part of a new clause, the contract clause, that expanded the reach of the statute. And then in 1948, as part of an overall recodification of Title 18, the statute was the Congress made some stylistic adjustments and some adjustments that made the statute permanent, but did not make any change to the scope of the statute, the scope of the which clause that is relevant here. It continued to modify only the third subclause. And now, appellee focuses on the 2008 enactment, but amendments, but that those amendments were limited in scope. They only expanded the trigger to include congressional authorizations for the use of military forces, in addition to formal declarations of war. They extended from 3 to 5 years the time after the end of the hostilities, and it clarified what the termination, how Congress, what kind of congressional action or executive action marked the termination of the statute of limitations. None of those amendments in any ways affected the text, which is critical here.
Counsel, do you know anything more about the history of the UCMJ section 843? Do you know when that was enacted?
I believe it was enacted in 19 1950, and then it was recodified in 1956.
Okay, and so when it was adopted in 1950, was it adopted in substantially the form that it is now?
Yes, the statute at large present the statute in the form that is presented now, with a pagination that makes clear that the which clause modifies only the third clause of the Suspension Act.
Okay, and did it include the semicolons that separate those three clauses?
The version printed in the statute at large does include it, yes.
Okay, the version in the statute at large in 1950 does include the semicolons.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
If I can also touch a little bit on the purpose of the act. I think there's been some argument made by the other side that the purpose of the act does not encompass this type of offense. But the purpose of the Suspension Act is really twofold. And I think the citation to the original 1942 legislative history that I just mentioned points in that direction. There is two goals. One is to preserve and protect the war effort, and one is to protect the purse of the United States and the United States' interests when its resources are naturally distracted by other more pressing events. And the scope of the first two clauses, as we interpret them, are integral to fulfilling the protection of the United States' purse at a time when its attention is diverted to other issues.
Counsel, is there any, what instances would be covered by paragraph three in the statute that would not be covered by one?
Right, so to begin with, sort of a general point, I want to give you some practical examples, but to begin with, of course, the canon against superfluity only comes into play when there is complete overlap, not just when there is redundancies. And so let's get to just to answer your question, though, I think one example we provide in our brief would be a case in which a contractor defrauds a subcontractor in connection with a war. In that case, that offense would not fall under the first clause, which is limited to frauds against the United States. Another example one could think of could probably be a price fixing conspiracy in connection with a war-related contract. That would not be necessarily defrauding, would not have necessarily, in all cases, defrauding the United States as an essential element, as requiring the United States versus Bridges. It also would not necessarily qualify under the second clause, but it qualifies under the third clause. And as a third
Counsel, in those examples, then you're relying on the fact that clauses one and two refer to the United States, but clause three does not.
Correct. Yes, correct. And just as a final example, I think that I could give you, it could be, for instance, even a violent offense committed by a security contractor in connection with a war. That would not be an offense that defrauds the United States. It would not be in connection with the acquisition, disposition, custody, or care of real or personal property of the United States, but it would be in connection with a contract which is related to the war or directly related to the...
But your position, just so I'm following, is that even if the conduct falls within one and three, the statute of limitations would not bar it. It would bar it if you... It only bars it if the conduct falls only in three and not under one.
Correct. I would just answer the question posed by Judge Bybee, which I understood to ask what work is left for Clause 3 to do under our interpretation of the statute. If Your Honors don't have any further questions at this time, I would like to reserve.
I do have a question. This is Judge Schroeder. I just want to understand the reach of your argument. Are we engaged in the authorized use of armed forces in Afghanistan now?
Yes, Your Honor, we are. There's a pending authorization, the 2001 authorization of use of military force, and none of the events that the statute envisions or identifies as terminating that authorization have come to pass. Congress specifically clarified in 2008 the type of event that would pose a termination. And in this case, there's been no argument that any of the specific actions listed in the statute have occurred.
Yeah, so have we been engaged in military operations for the last 20 years?
Yes, under the meaning of the statute, that we are. And one point that I want to make, Your Honor, there are substantial limitations to this. It's, just to take your question a little more broadly, to the statute, and those come from the requirements of Clause 1 and Clause 2, which, as the Supreme Court, I see I'm over my time. May I finish my answer?
Yeah, absolutely, answer.
Thank you. So there is statutory limitations that come from the substantive requirements reflected in Clause 1 and in Clause 2, such as the fact that a fraud has to be an essential ingredient of the offense, and that the fraud has to be pecuniary in nature. There is also constitutional and institutional limits. The Due Process Clause under Lovasco poses limits on pre-indictment delay independently of the application of any statute of limitations.
I understand that. So that a fraud committed in 2002, the statute of limitations hasn't run yet and won't run until 5 years after we are out of any military activity?
Only to the extent that it falls under one of the three clauses of the wartime
If it's under Clause 1, then there conceivably could be no statute of limitations at all.
That's correct. And that is the policy choice of Congress. With the lens of 2021, perhaps that looks like a policy choice that maybe is not the one that everyone will make today, but as the question at this point is whether the interpretation of the statute that we offer is overbroad vis-a-vis the policy choice that Congress did make.
When the statute was enacted, particularly during World War II, it wasn't contemplated that we would have these series of actions all over the world that developed after World War II, was it? So I'm not sure that this was a popular choice, but I understand your position. Thank you for answering.
I think, and if I may add just one final point, in 2008, when Congress did amend the statute, though, the 2001 authorization for use of military force had been in place for 7 years. And the Iraq surge had just happened years after the beginning of the war. Thank you very much.
And at that time, had any court interpreted the case, the clause, of the way that you are interpreting it?
At that time, had not the issue had not yet arisen.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, counsel. Ms. Dotson.
Yes, Your Honors. Good morning. My name is Deanna Dotson. I'm representing the appellee, Dwayne Gier. This particular statute, I think, has three parts to it. It has a triggering part, which is that you have to either have a declaration of war or an authorization by Congress, which right now we have the two authorizations by Congress that is applicable to this statute. Then you have the statute of limitations, which runs now for 5 years, but it doesn't start until after the termination of hostilities. What the government is arguing is that only Section 3, Offense 3, has the nexus to hostilities. However, the entire statute is dealing with hostilities. First, it starts with a hostility. You have to either have war, a declaration of war, or these authorizations. And then the end of these of the termination of these hostilities then starts the statute of limitations running again for the 5 years. So it states in the actual statute itself, it states that the running of statute of limitations is applicable to any offense, and it says 1, 2, or 3. And then this which clause comes in, gives the connection, the nexus, as the government is calling it too, which is connected with or related to the prosecution of the war, or directly connected or related with the authorized use of the armed forces. Counsel, I don't see how you can claim that.
How do you respond to the? I mean, I think if we're reading this, you know, if there weren't these amendments in 1944, I think this would be, you know, a really tough case, because you would have these two canons that sort of conflict. But what is your response to these 1944 amendments, where the which clause was specifically adopted, you know, before all three categories were in there. And then when the categories changed order, numerical order, the which clause followed the one that it was adopted with. That seems to be pretty good evidence that Congress adopted the which clause only in conjunction with the third clause.
Well, in 1944, you only had two offenses, one and two, and two was the contract clause, and that was the end of the clauses. And then the which, it shows the connection. You have to have a connection, a nexus to the related, the war, or now we have the authorization of war, which was not in 1944, but it said it has to be related to the prosecution of the present war. It still requires that you have to have some nexus to these hostilities. You just can't separate.
Counsel, what do you do with the UCMJ section 843?
With the USMJ, it's how they've designated their particular. They've separated each paragraph where they're not separated in the actual.
Right, but they're. In your section, which is what, 3257, 3287, 3287, they're separated, the clauses are separated by commas. Here they are separated by semicolons, but it's otherwise identical. I mean, it's word for word. Are you telling us that because they included semicolons, but it adopted word for word, they adopted a different statute than the one that they adopted here?
No, I'm not saying that. I think that still the which clause is read to say that you have to have the connection. You have to have the next.
Okay, I just want to make sure I understand your argument. Are you telling me that the which clause in 10 U.S.C. 843 F3 applies to F1 and F2?
Are you talking about the contract?
I'm talking about 10 U.S.C. section 843. I'm talking about the UCMJ provision.
Okay.
Does the which clause apply to F1 and F2?
Yes, I think it does, Your Honor.
How can it possibly?
Because you have to show a nexus. If you don't have a nexus, how can you connect the war with the termination of the hostilities that's in place, and then you have to have it related to those. Otherwise, you can just have any fraud or any property acquisition.
But counsel, where they're separated, I mean, to Judge Bybee's point, I mean, where they're separated like that and the which clause is only included in number three, I mean, I think for your argument to be correct, the which clause would have to like follow in a paragraph after 1, 2, and 3, but where it's only included in paragraph 3 and it's not included in paragraph 2 or 1, I don't understand how your argument flows.
Well, then how can you have in the WSLA, how can you have the nexus to hostilities requirement if it only applies to contracts? Because in the case that the government argued in Granger, that was a fraud case. That would be under category 1, correct? And they found that it had to be connected to, it had to be specifically related to the hostilities. And then because they had charges in 45, 46, and 47, and they said the 47 did not qualify because that was after the termination of hostilities. So that's very important that there's a link to the hostilities. So if you take the which clause out completely, then what are you saying? That there is no relationship at all? You can't. The which clause is applied to all.
Well, it seems to be exactly what they've done. I mean, the WSLA is admittedly more ambiguous, but if you compare it to the Uniform Code of Military Justice, this seems to be absolutely clear. If the WSLA were written as the Uniform Code of Military Justice was, I don't know how your argument could stand, unless there was something about the 2008 amendment that changed the WSLA. Because do you have an argument that the 2008 amendment may have amended it in such a way that the which clause, it makes a stronger position that the which clause applies to all three?
Well, I think the one thing that you can say is why the 2008 amendment came in, and it was to make under the legislative history that Senator Leahy proposed. He said it was to make current law suspending statute of limitations during wartime applicable to the ongoing conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. Well, if you're only going to have contract offenses, then what good is even listing the first two, one and two, if it's not going to apply? So you have to have that nexus to the war, because that's what the whole intent of this wartime statute, to extend the limitations period so the government would have more time to find all these charges, I mean, all these offenses, not just the third one. And they all have to be related to this wartime statute, which means it has to be related to the hostilities. Otherwise, what's the point of the statute? If you take out one and two and you only have three, that's what you're actually saying, is only three has to relate to the hostilities. But in actuality, they all have to relate. Otherwise, why have the declaration of war or these authorizations? And why have the termination related to the termination of these hostilities? That's the start of the new statute of limitation period. If it's only related to three, then one and two are almost irrelevant, because it has no meaning to the statute. You have to have all of that together. It has to relate. You have to have some relationship to the hostilities in order for the extension of the statute of limitation. You just can't have it to contracts. And in the Granger case, that was fraud, and they found that it was applicable, and it only under the 45 and 46 counts, because it happened before the termination and it happened during after the declaration of war. And so you have to make that connection, that it has to have a nexus to the hostilities.
But counsel, can you go on the Granger case? Maybe I didn't read it closely enough. I didn't see that it was specifically fraud versus contract. How do you get that it was specifically fraud and not contract?
Because it was violations of the False Claims Act. They were making fraudulent claims, and it says right here in the claims for money or property involving the element of deceit, which is the earmark of fraud. It says right there, it wasn't contracts, it was fraud. They were making claims, false claims, to the government. And that's the case that the government was relying on, was Granger.
Yeah.
And they said that it's the specific language to war contracts is what the government quoted, but actually it's stated in that thing. It said the running of, in Granger, it said the running of any existing statute of limitations applicable to any offense, one, involving fraud, the United States, or two, committing in connection with the performance of any contract, which that was all there was then, related to the prosecution of the present war. So they're relating it to, you have to have some nexus. Otherwise, why have this wartime statute if it doesn't have some nexus to what the hostilities are? You just can't eliminate it and say it only applies to contracts. It applies also to all the other two claims in the present statute.
Okay. I don't see any other questions. So, counsel, your time is done. But thank you; it's been helpful. Mr. Valenti, we'll give you a minute for rebuttal.
Thank you very much. I would like to make three points very briefly. Nishi's counsel just referenced a couple of times in relation to the hostilities. The statute, as we interpret, does require a relation to the hostilities. It's just a temporal relations. No one questions that the trigger and the end point of the suspensions is determined by the hostilities, by the congressional authorization for the use of military force. There is a connection. It just doesn't have to be a substantive connection for each of the three clauses. Second, with respect to Granger, Granger involved false claims made to a government corporation that had nothing to do with a war effort. There were wool purchases, and the defendants in those cases said and argued squarely to the Supreme Court, these purchases are nothing to do with a war effort. This, that the suspension does not apply. And the Supreme Court did not address that specific argument explicitly, but it found that the statute of limitation applies. So it's untenable, we think, to rely on Granger to support the appellee's position in this case. And finally, with respect to the 2008 amendments, one important point that the Supreme Court made in KBR is that Congress does not ordinarily hide fundamental changes to the scope of a statute in, quote, subtle moves. And in this case, the district court's theory and Nish's theory on appeal appears to turn entirely on either legislative history or other moves that have no grounding in the text, in the history, or in the context of the statute. The court doesn't have any...
Was Article 43F of the Code of Military Justice, was it adopted as a separate standalone provision, or was it part of the entire code? Just out of curiosity.
Now, Your Honor, I believe it was part of the entire Uniform Code of Military Justice. That's my understanding, that when it was first enacted in 1950, it was part of the overall enactment.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Unless the court has any further questions, we ask the court to reverse the judgment and remand for further proceedings.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments in this case. The case is now submitted. We'll move on to our second case for argument today, Francine Huerta versus Andrew M. Saul, case number 19-15402.